consultant, WGTD Walworth County correspondent Jim McClure, and by Marlo Harmon, a lifelong Racine resident who's currently employed as an addiction counselor at Racine Correctional Institution. And now, here's today's host.
Good morning, I'm Jim McClure at the Yerkes Observatory in Williams Bay, Wisconsin, with Dan Kaler, tour guide, who will explain what the summer solstice is and so many other things.
Well, the solstice means that this is basically the longest amount of solar influx that we get for the year. This is the maximum amount of sunshine that we get because the Earth's axis is tipped on a 23.5 degree angle. We're tipped towards the sun right now, and we're getting a lot of sunlight. It's the exact opposite of winter when we're tipped in the exact opposite direction. So days are very long right now, averaging something on the order of 15 and a half hours of sunlight a day. So that's the longest day of the year is occurring right now. We'll have that going on for a little while, and then you'll start to notice that the days are getting shorter again. So we'll start moving back towards the winter solstice when days start getting very, very short.
What's to be seen in the sky in the closing week or so of June?
Well, in June, we've got, at the very end of the month, we have a conjunction of Jupiter and Venus. And what that means is those two planets from our line of sight here on Earth are going to appear to be very, very close to each other. In fact, they're 0.3 degrees apart on the 30th, which is less than the diameter of the moon. So you're going to see two very bright objects, solar system objects, that are right next to each other.
And as one observes with what you have to observe with here at Yerkes, what does one see in terms of detail?
Well, in that kind of case, this particular conjunction is going to show those two disks of those planets almost exactly the same size. Even though Venus is about 40 million miles away from us, and at that point, Jupiter will be something on the order of 550 million miles away, those two planets are going to appear very, very much like the same size. And they will not be visible in the same eyepiece field. We don't have eyepieces that are wide enough to show that, but just be able to nudge the telescope from one to the other and compare the two.
Give me a layman's example of how far away these things are and how big they are. I tend to think of, you know, millions of light years, and yet it's still impressive how many Earths fit within and how far out there. What are those exact figures?
Well, Venus is an Earth-like planet. It's almost exactly, in fact, it's oftentimes referred to as Earth's twin. So it's approximately the same size, about 8,000 miles in diameter, give or take a little bit. But its atmosphere and its whole situation is very much different than ours. So it is a planet that is half as close to the sun as we are. So we're twice as far away from the sun as Venus is, and it has a very, very dense, thick atmosphere made actually mostly of sulfuric acid. So not a very hospitable place. At the surface, it has what is oftentimes referred to as the runaway greenhouse effect. So it traps solar radiation in and makes that surface temperature extremely hot. In fact, it's about 900 degrees at the surface. So it's hot enough to melt lead on the surface of Venus. So it's not a hospitable place at all. And looking through the telescope, there's really no detail to be seen on Venus simply because it's completely shrouded in clouds. So we can't see that surface.
So you see, in essence, a solid color. You don't see any variation or...
It's a whitish appearance, but Venus does show phases like the moon because its orbit is inside that of Earth. So we see that planet at different angles as it orbits around the sun, just like we see that same phase effect with the moon. So right now, at the end of June, we're looking at about one half phase is oftentimes what we refer to it as. It appears to look something like a first quarter moon, but there's no detail to be seen, but we just see one half of the planet. The entire sphere is illuminated on one half of its entire surface by the sun, but from our angle, from our aspect, we can only see a sliver of that because we're looking at it at an oblique angle. So we see it as a crescent phase, and it's going to be getting more and more and more like a crescent as it moves towards us. In the sky, and it's going to be getting just a little bit brighter. And then eventually it'll reach something called inferior conjunction, which means it'll pass between the Earth and the sun, and it'll leave our evening sky and become a morning sky object at that point.
How rare is it for these two planets to be this close together in our visible sky?
I would say that it happens every few years. It's not something that happens frequently, but both planets have to be in the same part of the sky at the same time. Now, this can happen in the morning sky as well. So as the planets move around the sun and they pass, as I say, I often refer to it as just passing from morning to evening sky or evening to morning sky, as they rotate around the sun, they have to be in the same general part of the sky in order for that conjunction to occur. So they have to be visible either together in the morning or together in the evening. So it's not something that's terribly uncommon, but perhaps once every 3 years or so we might see a conjunction that's this close of those two planets.
How much detail can you see through the university's reflector on Jupiter? Do you see the details that we know from our books in grade school?
There actually is an amazing amount of detail that can be seen with almost any telescope, but the 24-inch that we use for the public programs does a tremendous job. When Jupiter is relatively close to us, we see different details in its atmosphere. There are two belts, for example, dark belts. They're kind of reddish in color, brownish red, I guess would be the way to describe that. And they're referred to as the north and south equatorial belts. And the equator of the planet runs right through the center of those two belts. And those are caused by the different types of gases that are in the atmosphere of Jupiter. It is composed mostly of hydrogen, helium, carbon dioxide, methane, ammonia, gases like that that mix in different proportions and cause different colors in the atmosphere of that planet. When it's close to us, and it was in February of this year, then we start to see little white circles and little blue circles. They're called festoons in the atmosphere. That whole planetary atmosphere can break up into all kinds of different detail that can be seen. The Great Red Spot, which is a gigantic hurricane that is incorporated into that south equatorial belt. Very common, very easy to see when the planet is closer to us than it is right now. And the problem for us now is that it's setting fairly early in the evening, right after the sun. It's getting kind of low. It's far away from us. In order for us to see those kind of details, we're going to have to wait for it to come back around again next late winter next year in 2016. And into the spring months, we'll be seeing that again. But there's a tremendous amount of detail to be seen. And then there's the four Galilean satellites, the four very bright moons of Jupiter. Jupiter has 63 moons in total, but there's four of them that are very special, and they change orientation within an hour, 2 hours. We can see the movement of those satellites around the planet, so it's very interesting to watch that as well. They play a game of hide-and-seek. Some of them will sometimes be behind the planet when we're first looking at it with the telescope, and gradually they'll emerge from the planet's shadow, and they'll come back out and reemerge. So it's an extremely interesting process to watch.
As one steps out into their backyard, what direction do they want to look, and what time of night is the viewing best for the conjunction and for Jupiter?
Well, for the conjunction on June 30th, it's going to be almost unmistakable. All you do is basically point yourself due west, slightly to the northwest, and you'll see two bright objects not too far off the horizon. And in the case of that particular conjunction, it'll be close to full moon at that time. So the moon will be on the opposite side of the sky, so it'll be coming up in the east. This event will be occurring in the west, so it'll be there by itself. The moon isn't involved in this conjunction this time around. That actually adds another dimension to the whole equation. Sometimes the crescent moon is involved in those conjunctions as well. We won't be lucky enough this time to have that occurrence happen, but that is something that could happen when you have a conjunction of these two planets occurring. So it's going to be pretty easy for, I think, most people to just look to the west and see two bright points of light. Sometimes they are actually mistaken for UFOs. Sometimes they're mistaken for airplanes, things like that. But there'll be a steady glow on the western horizon side by side, and then they'll just gradually set towards the western horizon as the evening progresses and disappear below the horizon. The next night when people look at this, they'll still be there. They'll just be a little bit farther apart.
How many Earths fit inside Jupiter?
The number is actually 318. So if you take, that's the volume of the planet. So if you take 318 of our planet planet-sized orbs and put that inside of Jupiter, that's what you would have. So that's it's the king of the planets, as we say. It's the largest in our solar system.
And Venus is smaller than us.
Just slightly. It's pretty much very, very similar in size. Like I mentioned before, it's pretty much like Earth's twin, essentially, although a very inhospitable place to live. Not an environment like we have, but it is a planet that is very similar to Earth.
Let's take our Yerkes starship now out to the, I assume out of the Milky Way. What's this business I read about of exploding stars out there? Where are they and what's going on?
Well, about a decade ago, and astronomers are finding interesting objects all over the sky all the time. Hubble Space Telescope has been extremely valuable in finding objects like this. Three lone stars were identified that are not associated with any galaxy. They appear to be floating in what we would call interstellar space. They're just out there floating between the galaxies. And it turns out that each one of those is a binary. So they are rotating around a common center of gravity. And each of them had what is called a white dwarf, which is a white dwarf companion, which is a small cinder of a star that basically has stopped its nuclear fusion process because it didn't have enough mass to turn carbon. That's the end of a white dwarf's life, is the attempt of, it doesn't have enough mass to fuse carbon into other elements. So our sun, for example, fuses hydrogen, four atoms of hydrogen, into one atom of helium. Then when it runs out of hydrogen, it will start fusing helium into carbon. And some stars are massive enough to take carbon and fuse that into oxygen, and oxygen into other elements. But these particular white dwarfs pretty much stopped at the carbon phase. They just did not have enough mass in order to continue the nuclear fusion process. But what they did wind up doing is gravitationally attracting material from their bigger companion, which is still fusing helium into other elements. And what that did is it created kind of an explosion, a collapse of the core. That dead core suddenly heated up very violently and actually wound up exploding in what we call a type 1A supernova. So that's a very common type of supernova. There are actually three different types. It's one of the very common types where one star grabs material off its companion. It's actually stopped its nuclear fusion process up until that point, but it grabs mass, it becomes a more massive star, and very violently explodes in what we call a type 1A supernova. And so that's what occurred with each one of those three exploding stars that were way off adrift out in space on their own.
Fireworks closer to home, I suppose, in terms of interesting lights in the sky, perhaps takes the form of asteroids. What's happening this time of year in the world of asteroids?
Well, asteroids themselves, we actually had a spacecraft visit Ceres, which is one was considered the largest asteroid. It was the very first asteroid that was discovered in 1801. And it's a now considered what we call a dwarf planet. That's the same category that we put Pluto in as well. So it's a spherical object, but it's occupying an orbit with a whole bunch of other smaller objects. So Pluto is basically doing the exact same thing. It's out in what we call the Kuiper Belt, which is an area very external to the main part of our solar system that is composed mostly of icy bodies. They're mostly ice. There's some rock, some solid material like that involved in those dwarf planets as well. But there's actually been planets that have been discovered that are bigger than Pluto. But as far as Ceres is concerned, it's been taken out of the asteroid category and put into the it's been put into the dwarf planet category. And so we have one spacecraft that has visited that now for the first time and given us some very good close-up views. But what we're more interested in the summertime in is a lot of people like to see meteors, and we have the very best meteor shower of the year. It's called the Perseid meteor shower, and it's so named because it seems to radiate. Those meteors seem to come out of the constellation of Perseus, and the peak of that is usually the evening of August 11th and 12th, and the best time to look for those is generally after midnight when the Earth is turned into the stream of meteor material, and they're going very much faster. They're hitting our atmosphere at a very high speed, so they burn very bright very quickly, and they're extremely interesting to watch. But what they are really are bits of comets. They're not really associated with asteroids. They're little bits of a comet, the tail of which crossed through the Earth's orbit many, many years ago and left that material behind. There's a trail of material that orbits behind a comet as it orbits the sun. And as the Earth passes through that material, we wind up with a meteor shower. So that's what the Perseid meteor shower is all about.
What happened that we lost our that Pluto lost its designation as a planet? We just learned more about it, right? And
well, the definition of a planet has continued to change over the centuries. At one point in time, I believe that we had something on the order of 12. We kept astronomers kept discovering asteroids, so they referred to those as planets until they realized that they really weren't the same type of object like the Earth or Mercury or Jupiter is. So we, back in the 19th century, knew about the eight planets, and then four large asteroids, Ceres, Vesta, Pallas, and Juno, were all discovered. So they were added to the planetary category as well. So at one time, we actually had 12. But then astronomers decided, well, those really are not Ceres, Pallas, Vesta, and Juno are really not planets. They're actually asteroids because they occupy an area where there are lots of bodies like that. They just happen to be the largest of the four. So then they got demoted from planets to asteroids. Then Pluto was discovered in 1930. So it was theorized that there was a planet beyond Neptune. There were irregularities in Neptune's orbit that couldn't be explained any other way than to imagine that there must be a very large planet of some kind that's tugging on it, that's farther out than Neptune is. And there's very quite possibly could still be a very large planet out there that we have not discovered. But actually, Pluto is not big enough to cause the variations in Neptune's orbit. So almost immediately after Pluto was discovered, the debate already started as to whether or not it should be classified as a planet. But for some reason, people got attached to it. Astronomers kind of fought the idea, but people thought, well, we now have nine planets. There's Pluto as well. But as we learned more about Pluto, we realized that it was pretty much a rocky body, but it also had a tremendous amount of ice associated with it as well, because it's 40 times farther, at least 40 times farther out in its orbit than the Earth is, and it also is highly eccentric, so very egg-shaped. Its orbit sometimes brings it closer into the Sun than Neptune. So it actually crosses Neptune's orbit and comes in closer, and for about a 20-year period, not all that long ago, it actually was the eighth planet from the Sun, not the ninth, as we had always been taught that it was. So that started to raise some suspicions, too, was the high eccentricity of its orbit. Then we started discovering that there were other bodies out in that area, too. So what are we going to do? Are we going to add those as planets as well? There's an object out there called Sedna. There's an object called Quaoar. Both of those are very, very similar to Pluto, but they live out in an area that we call the Kuiper Belt. And interestingly enough, Gerard Kuiper, who was a planetary scientist, is a former director here at Yerkes. He is the originator of the idea that there was a spherical body of ice, or a spherical shaped grouping of icy bodies surrounding the sun it's closer in than what we call the Oort cloud, which are true ice bodies. That's where we get our comets from. That would be the true external extremities of our solar system. So the Kuiper Belt is between the known solar system, what we consider the eight general solar system planets, and the Oort cloud. We have this area called the Kuiper Belt. And it's kind of a transition between rock and ice. So there's some rock, some ice, but they're not really planets, but they're not really asteroids, and they're not really comet bodies either. So Pluto got thrown into that category, and we now refer to those as dwarf planets. So they have some similarities toward planets, some similarities towards the nature of asteroids. So a whole new category was created, and we call them dwarf planets now. So that's what happened to Pluto.
We have an asteroid day coming up, and for both children and adults. Tell us a little bit about that. Who's going to be organizing it, and what do you get to see and experience?
This is organized by what we call YEO, which is Yerkes Educational Outreach. And it's a whole day devoted to studying asteroids. This is actually something of an international activity. Asteroid Day has been declared. It's June 30th, as a matter of fact. So we're going to have a special program here, educational program in the evening, specifically on a talk about asteroids and different activities for kids to and adults, for that matter, to participate in so that they can learn more about what asteroids are. And it gets into this question of what's an asteroid, what's a dwarf planet, what's the definition of a planet, what are comets, and how all of those types of bodies are very, very different.
And when one comes here, will they be meeting with, you know, Yerkes personnel, seeing anything, mostly a presentation through?
I believe it's all basically going to be a presentation about asteroids, but I'm sure there'll be some telescope viewing available that evening with portable instruments on the south lawn of the observatory as well. We almost always incorporate some type of astronomical viewing with telescopes into these types of programs.
You know, we have the three almost, you know, they're almost a icon of the area, the three domes,
mm-hmm.
with, you know, the original 40-inch refractor and the 24-inch reflector that you use for nighttime viewing, and also the 40-inch reflector. But when one gets out on the enormous, beautiful back lawn, you also see two or three little domes. What's mm-hmm. what's inside those miniature observatories?
The smallest one that's closest to the building is referred to as Sirius B, and it's actually a solar research telescope or that type of telescope. It's used specifically for looking at the sun in a wavelength called hydrogen alpha, which is the sun is a strong emitter in that particular wavelength. So it's a way of studying cutting through the photosphere of the sun and looking specifically at the inner regions of the sun where that all of that, those convection currents are occurring, that all of that energy is boiling up from the central part of the sun, from its central core where it's doing its nuclear fusion, where it's fusing hydrogen into helium. So we get to see a lot of detail with that on the surface of the sun, so to speak. Takes away the photosphere, that's that very bright sunlight that we see during the day, and it gets down towards more of what we would refer to as the surface of the sun so that we can see different objects. There's things called filaments. We can see sunspots. We can see granulation, which are convection currents rising and falling as heat is coming out of the sun and those gases are cooling and going back down again, so it forms a granulated type of surface feature. So that's what's in Sirius B. The two farther domes that are farther out, one of them houses a 12-inch Meade robotic telescope that is used sometimes for public programs as well. The other dome that's attached to that building houses something called a Schmidt camera, which is a combination of a telescope and a camera, currently not being used. It uses film for taking pictures, so that has been kind of a dormant instrument for a while, but the other dome that has the 12-inch Meade is used from time to time. So we have some auxiliary instruments here. This is an extremely well-equipped observatory. There are a lot of portable instruments here that can be taken out onto the lawn in addition to the ones that are permanently mounted.
Measuring the sun, looking at the sun, observing the sun, it really goes back to the origins of the observatory itself, doesn't it, given the first director, Mr. Hale?
Absolutely. George Ellery Hale is considered the father of modern astrophysics. His main goal when he decided to take up a career in astronomy was that he wanted to understand stars, and he really wanted to understand how they gave off light and heat. In 1897, when the observatory opened, people in general, I think astronomers in particular, were getting away from that idea, but people imagined that the sun and the stars were gigantic balls of fire. They had absolutely no idea where the energy source came from for that fire, but that's what they imagined the stars to be. George Ellery Hale knew better. He understood something called spectroscopy. He knew there were different elements that those stars were composed of. So it was through spectroscopy and the analysis of starlight that the whole idea of nuclear fusion and the understanding of nuclear fusion occurred about a quarter of a century or so after the observatory opened. And the Yerkes refractor, along with other telescopes, helped contribute to that body of knowledge. So that's really why the Yerkes refractor was built in the first place, was as a true astrophysical instrument doing spectrographic work, which is the analysis of starlight, to understand and classify stars, to get that's how they got the spectral classification down. They looked at different colors of stars, which tell us what temperatures they are, tells us about their age and so on, where they are in their lifespans, what they're fusing. Are they fusing hydrogen into helium? Are they fusing helium into carbon? Are they fusing carbon into oxygen as they move through their lifespans? So that is the type of thing that George Eller Hale was in particular interested in. Now, he used the sun as an example of a star that is the closest one to us. So he was extremely interested in the sun because it's big, it's bright, it's easy to observe, and he was able to use spectroscopy to analyze starlight and really get a true understanding of what was going on. He is the discoverer of the many of the magnetic properties of the sun, the magnetic character of sunspots, for instance, and tied that all to the solar cycle, that every 11 years, sunspots increase and then they decrease. So that whole span of time takes 22 years. So our sun is a little bit on the variable side. It puts out just a little bit more energy at certain times and a little less at other times, but it's a very stable star in general. But we will see the development of sunspots at higher latitudes, and then all of a sudden they'll start forming at lower latitudes, and then the sun will appear to be peppered with sunspots, and then that process will begin to reverse, and those sunspots will disappear. So he's really the person who, in the end, taught us a lot about the solar cycle, the magnetic properties of the sun, and how the sun does its work, how it fuses helium, hydrogen into helium, and how it gives off light and heat as a byproduct of that nuclear fusion.
Dan, it's hard for anyone who visits Yerkes or goes on one of your Saturday tours or one of your nighttime observations, it's hard for them not to describe all this as a moving experience as they realize the breadth of the universe, the depth of the architecture here. But moving is something that has been a bit of a problem. You had some mechanical difficulties, and now I understand that you have good news as to what people will be able to see on their Saturdays and experience.
Well, once again, it occurred in October. We have this is an old building, and it's got old equipment, and the University of Chicago has done a great job of maintaining the equipment here over the years, and there's been an effort to really keep things as original as possible. So we still work with a lot of 19th century equipment. The refractor, built in the 19th century, is powered by two DC or direct current motors that were built in the 19th century by Westinghouse. They've been certified, actually, to be the oldest motors of their type that Westinghouse built that are still in operation. So that's pretty amazing when you think about it. But what turns the dome and causes our rising floor to raise and lower are two gigantic, they're about 2 tons apiece, but they're only 25-horse motors that were built by a company called Siemens & Halske. Now, today we know that as a Siemens Corporation. So today we take alternating current and convert it to DC and still run those same motors. Well, our Siemens & Halske motor that ran that runs the elevated floor has a shaft that comes off of it, goes into a transmission that runs to four axles that pull on a series of weights that are around the room. It's a counterweighted floor that causes that floor to rise and fall through a distance of 26 feet, depending upon the angle that the telescope is looking at. In October last year, that shaft broke, and this is actually the third time that that's happened, and at least in the last 20 years, but this time it broke internally. So then a decision had to be made as to whether we were going to preserve that old DC motor that was built, by the way, in 1896. We were going to preserve that motor, or if we were going to replace it with a 21st century upgrade. So the decision was made to get the motor fixed. It was an extremely expensive repair, but at the beginning, actually toward the end of May, the motor came back, was reinstalled, and after an absence of about 8 months, it's now been able to raise and lower the floor once again.
As we move into the rest of the summer, you have lots of children all over, not just with the tours, but exploring on their own. Talk about the whole outreach here to children of all ages.
We have a division of the observatory, which is called YEO, which is Yerkes Educational Outreach. And that program is operated by science teachers who are employed during the summer and some during the entire year to work with teachers to teach them how to teach astronomy to their students during the regular school year. So those kind of programs take place at times outside of the summer. But during the summer months, we have children from about fifth grade on up to about eighth grade. And they're broken by age categories into what we call now tech camps. So they're actually learning, they learn some astronomy. There's definitely astronomy involved in that educational process. But more and more, we've been trying to promote technical education and mechanical education and promote engineering and engineering science. So these kids are learning how to make robots, for instance. They have to design and manufacture a robot. They have to start understanding electronics and mechanics and physics and math. So that's all involved in the creation of these devices that they create in the week that they spend with us. So it's a day camp. Some in the evening, one evening every week, we put on a star party for those children and their siblings and their parents. So we do throw some astronomy in there basically as well. But most of the camps that we're doing now, at least at this stage, have to do with engineering and learning more about mechanics.
And the kids and parents, they're staying where? Here at the observatory and also at the local college?
Most of them are local students. So they're staying, they're at home and their parents drop them off here. We have in the past had children come up from the city of Chicago, and they will come here to the observatory to do their work. Those are more astronomy camps. Those kids are staying usually at George Williams College below the hill here, so they'll sleep down there, and they'll come up here and study, do their projects during the day. They have nighttime activities as well. That particular program actually dates to the 1980s. We've been doing that type of program for a long time, and that's for high school students. So they spend anywhere from 3 or 4 days at a time to an entire week here at the observatory. They will be back toward the end of August, and they'll be working here again with that particular camp. They're usually here twice a year, usually in the summer and then again in the winter right around Christmas time during their Christmas break.
The need for volunteers apparently is becoming quite necessary.
Yes, we have a limited staff here to do tours. There are three guides here that work either on a full-time or part-time basis. But Yerkes has become a true destination in Williams Bay and in the Geneva Lake area. And our Saturday programs have become extremely popular. And during the summer, our crowds can get quite large. And what we would like to be able to do is not have so many people on one tour, 60 or 70 or 80 at a time, where we lose that intimate contact with individuals. We like to be able to keep the group smaller so people can ask questions, so they can really get to know their tour guide. They can hear everything that's going on. They can see everything that's going on. And in order to do that, we would like to be able to run more tours on a Saturday. Right now, we do three of them at 10:15, 11:15, and 12:15. We would really like to be able to do it, especially during the summer. We'd like to do more like five or six tours and start those on the every half hour so that we can keep the group smaller. In order to do that, the guides are going to be very busy because we function as greeters as well as guides. So when we're not doing tours, we're actually functioning as a greeter to explain to people what's going on and when the next tour is going to occur and where the restrooms are located and where the displays are located and what they can find in the gift shop and answer simple questions like that while they're waiting for their tour to begin. We would like to start up, and we do have a few people now who are interested in becoming docents here at the observatory. We've never had a formal docent program before, so that's what we're looking for, is people who are interested in volunteering, not every single Saturday, but maybe one or two Saturdays a month to help us out with those programs. So it's a great destination for people to come here. We would love to have people from the Williams Bay area who can describe more things that people can become involved with as they visit the observatory. This isn't the only thing that they can see here in Williams Bay. And a lot of times they want people want to know where to have lunch once they leave the observatory. So having some local guides, local docents who can help with that, those kind of questions would be very valuable to really give a great experience here to everyone who comes to the observatory.
as a really lovely place to visit, too. I understand that the observatory also has an attraction to groups, churches, weddings, you name it. What kind of congregations of people have come out here over the years?
Well, pretty much you name it, we've had that kind of a group. We do sponsor weddings, so brides and grooms can become married here at the observatory. We do a few of those a year. Generally speaking, those are conducted on our south lawn. We cannot host a reception here or a dinner of any kind. We don't have the capacity for doing that, but it does make a lovely backdrop for a wedding ceremony. And so we do have a handful of those every year. We have a lot of corporate events, boards of directors of companies, annual meetings of companies can come here and have wine, hors d'oeuvres, mix and mingle type parties like that, and get some of their business conducted, and then also be in a very historic building and get a tour of the facility as well. So we have organized events like that we sponsor. We have busloads of people that come who are touring the area, who will stop by for a tour during the week, and we'll usually give them about a one-hour walkthrough tour of the entire facility. We have local groups that come here. We have college groups that come in from time to time. There are perhaps astronomy classes that are looking for an experience of looking through our big telescopes here, learning more about astronomy, learning about the importance of Yerkes being the home of the world's largest refracting or lens-type telescope. They probably, in their textbook, have seen a picture of the Yerkes refractor because it appears in just about every textbook that's ever been published since the time that it was built and opened in 1897. So they have an opportunity to come here and actually see the physical instrument for themselves and to learn something about optics, to learn something about astronomy, in addition to what they're learning in the classroom.
There's a point in the tour where one realizes that Yerkes will continue being at the forefront. I understand there's the latest, biggest, giant, largest telescope under construction somewhere else in the world, and that Yerkes people are a part of that. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Sure. That's called the Giant Magellan Telescope, or GMT for short. And ground was just broken in the month of May in a place called Las Campanas, which is an observatory, established observatory already in the Andes Mountains in Chile, at an altitude of about 14,000 feet. So it's an ideal place to perform astronomical observations and research work. So the University of Chicago joined a consortium in 2005 of different organizations. Harvard University is part of that. So is the University of Arizona, Texas A&M, University of Texas, the National Observatories of Brazil, of South Korea, of Australia. There's a total of 15 different organizations that have pooled their resources to build a very, very expensive telescope, probably on the order of $800 million or so. It will be a 25-meter diameter mirror complex. So what that means is it's a multi-segmented mirror. There's actually seven mirrors in that telescope that form one gigantic mirror that is 25 meters in diameter. And to give perspective to that, if that mirror was here at Yerkes, it would fill the entire diameter of our 90-foot dome, 90-foot diameter dome. So 25 meters is approximately 90 feet in diameter. So that is a seven-segment mirror that would fill our dome. That will be the world's largest telescope when it opens approximately 2020, 2021. So we have to wait approximately another 4 to 5 years for that instrument to be completed. But ground was broken on the building construction in May of 2015, and the entire instrument and building should be completed about 2021.
And do we still have people working on the SOFIA telescope, even though it's getting ready to fly? Is there still a little work on that going on here?
We still have engineers who are working here at Yerkes who are, the problem with that instrument is that technology keeps moving forward. And we built that detector for that telescope for NASA. It is was designed about 7 years ago now, and NASA got it delivered 2 years ago in 2013, and then immediately ordered some new alterations to it, some new improvements to it. It is flying. It is working. And I think Yerkes is always going to be involved in the SOFIA infrared detecting telescope in terms of its actual camera, which was manufactured here at the labs here in our facility. So I think we're going to have an attachment to that particular instrument for a long time to come.
And it flies on an adapted 747. And what does it give us that we haven't had before in our observations of the universe?
It gives us the ability to do infrared astronomy. And infrared is absorbed by water vapor. So it's something that can be done in space. We have infrared detecting telescopes that are orbiting the Earth. But this gives us the ability to have one that we can move across the country in aircraft. So it's in the rear of the aircraft. It's a telescope built in the rear of that aircraft, and astronomers fly in the front end and do their research work that way. So flying at about 45,000 feet of elevation gets us above a good deal of the water vapor that would absorb infrared radiation from objects in space. So it's just another way to analyze the universe across the electromagnetic spectrum. We can look at the universe in X-rays, in gamma rays, in ultraviolet, in visible wavelengths, which is very common with the optical telescopes that are on the surface of the Earth. And infrared is and radio waves is on the opposite end of the visible spectrum, just another way for us to look at the universe and get other information about the galaxy that we live in and the universe that we're that we live in.
And finally, Dan, the ability to tour here, which is what most people know about Yerkes, a wrap-up on the Curtis status of when you can come out and what are the special events and how you go about signing up and making reservations and when it's open to the public as well.
There are several ways to visit Yerkes. Probably the easiest thing to do is to come to one of our Saturday programs where we give tours between 10 o'clock in the morning and 1 o'clock in the afternoon. That's the easiest way to do it, and we do ask for donations for those programs, but they are free to the public, so that's the best way for the public to be able to come in and see the building and learn about its history and see its architecture and see the 40-inch refractor. If you'd like to do a private program, you can do that as well. We call those walk-in tours, and those are available during the week, Monday through Friday. People can call here at the observatory and make arrangements to have a private tour. There is a charge for that, and the guide will explain that at the time that the listener calls and wants to learn about that particular program. So those are called walk-in tours, and those are conducted during the week. The other thing that we do here is we do a lot of telescope observation with our 24-inch reflecting telescope. That's in on certain evenings every month of the year. They can learn about what nights we have available by visiting our website. Simplest thing to do is just simply Google the name Yerkes Observatory. Our website will pop up right away in a Google search. And I believe it's the third selection on our homepage. It says look through a big telescope. If you click on that link, you'll learn all about the 24-inch observing program and the dates that we have available for people to register. There is a charge for that program as well, and that is a very limited program as far as size is concerned. That program is extremely popular, so reservations are required, and that's all done through email, and that's all explained on that webpage.
Best way to prepare physically in terms of how you dress, and best way to prepare mentally for experiencing your time at Yerkes?
If you're coming on the 24-inch tour, it depends upon the time of year. Those domes are not heated, so if it's cold outside, it's going to be cold in that dome. So you want to make sure that you're dressed appropriately. We prefer that people wear things like sturdy shoes, closed-toed shoes, because they're walking up and down metal stairs that can injure toes, and people can slip and fall easily on flip-flops and things like that, so we don't want that kind of apparel. So we want people to be prepared for that. As far as mentally prepared, just bring an open mind, because we're going to show you objects that you've never heard of before. You're going to learn a lot about astronomy and the things that astronomers study, and you're going to get a firsthand look at some very, very interesting objects, get very, very good views through our 24-inch telescope. If you're coming for an architectural talk, a historical talk, there's a lot of surprises here at the observatory. People take a look at the different architectural features and wonder what they're about. We're pretty good at explaining what we know about those, and we're also pretty good at explaining what we don't know about those architectural details. So there's a lot of fun things to look at. There's a lot of fun facts to learn about. Charles Yerkes, who donated the observatory to the University of Chicago, is a fascinating individual. We talk about his life and who he was and what he accomplished in his life in addition to building this observatory. And we talk about the history and some of the great discoveries and some of the great things that have been done here. So it's just a fun place to be. We get excellent comments and compliments on our programs. And